Today's interview is with Ellen Ronalds-Keene. And Ellen, I think, came into my sphere when she joined Radcasters and launched her podcast, Self Care for Teachers. Then she's been a big part of my Show Up, Speak Up community and came on my retreat. And I love her to bits. She's a little bit feisty and interestingly has done so much work around being the good girl. And I find this really interesting because I see her as a really bold person, someone who's not afraid to take chances, someone who does speak up when things need to be said. She will put on her teacher's hat, I guess, and say the thing. So I'm really excited to have this conversation. The takeaway is like mind-blowing. And something that I'm definitely going to take on board in a big way. So without further ado, let me introduce you to the amazing Ellen Ronalds-Keene.
Welcome to Carlosophy's Stories Behind Success. I'm Carly Nimmo. It's so easy to fall into comparisonitis as an entrepreneur, and it can be paralyzing. In my own journey, I've come to understand that regardless of your level of success, fame, or fortune, we're all suffering from the same stories of fear, struggle, and failure. So let's talk about it.
I think my story is essentially around, you know, letting go of the good girl and listening to my body. That's probably like that's the takeaway at the start already. So there you go. Interview done.
Start with the end. Okay. See you later.
Begin with the end in mind. Well, yeah, exactly. So I'm Ellen. I'm from Queensland. I grew up in a pretty, I would say, sheltered life, I guess, in the sense that my mum's a Uniting Church minister. So on one hand, I've always felt very much like I'm, you know, grew up with this really strong church upbringing, which like at school and stuff always made me feel a bit like an outsider because, you know, I was the good girl and I was also a really high achiever at school as well. So I wasn't cool and I didn't kind of fit in that sense. And I did get teased a bit, especially for being like religious in inverted commas. But at the same time, you know, I feel like I also lived a bit of an unconventional, probably minister's kid life because the minister in our household was a woman. Usually like when people think being a preacher's kid. Yeah, it is actually. It's less unusual these days. And certainly in the Uniting Church, there's quite a number of female ministers. It's still not the standard. And like, it is something that I have to remember to tell people when they're like, oh, you're a preacher's kid. I'm like, yeah, but you know, my mum and dad, and I say something about it, and they're like, oh, wait, your dad's an electrician? And I'm like, yeah. Oh, it's my mum that's the minister. Because people just assume that it was my dad because it's a traditionally male role. And so, I got a really interesting probably role reversal in terms of my mum being the breadwinner growing up and also using her voice as her profession. And she's been a bit of a – not to make this whole episode about my mum, but she's been a bit of a quiet trailblazer in her own way. She was the first female army chaplain in Australia back in the early 90s. So I've always also grown up with a really strong sense that, like, girls can do anything, like, seriously. And my dad was a house husband for a lot of my certainly teenage years when mum's career was probably more centre stage. And that really shaped me in ways I probably didn't realise, especially until like now in my, I just turned 30 last year and, you know, all at the same time with the Donald Trump stuff. And I feel like there's been a bit of an uprising of women exploring the things that have shaped them and the barriers that we have sometimes systems put in place, but sometimes we've put them on ourselves. And, I feel like having grown up with a really strong female role model really shaped me. But at the same time, I grew up in a really conservative, like in a church environment where there was this really strong good girl thing that's taken me I'm still shaking it off. I'm still trying to learn how to shed that expectation.
Yeah. And I think as a society, that's what we're doing at the moment, right? Like, it's been the status quo for so long. that it's only when you've moved out of it and you can see it from a, you know, from a different perspective. It's like a light has been shined on it.
Absolutely.
And it's been just lurking in the darkness for a long time. And so now we can see it where, and I feel like this is part of the struggle of this whole, feminine rising thing, right? Is that it's like with the Harvey Weinstein thing and all the stuff that's going on at the moment, men can feel a bit like, whoa, what has happened here? Because what they were just operating from a status quo too. You know, it wasn't right. but nothing was ever, like, it was never made wrong either.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, I grew up like with this really strong female role model, and with very much, I feel like, not just me, but probably my generation. So I'm 30. So, grew up with this really strong, like, girls can do anything message. And it was, and then I obviously grew up in my household where my mother was also the breadwinner. So it was like a double whammy in terms of that message for me. I have no reason to doubt that until I kind of hit the workforce and then, oh, okay, no, I see there are some structures in place here that do make it, you know, more difficult, and men seem to get promoted more, et cetera, et cetera. But I've also really noticed, like, some of the blokes that I went to school with have been, and even my husband to a certain extent, a bit taken aback by some of this feminine rising stuff, because they also grew up thinking, well, girls can do anything. I know they can, because I've, you know, our generation kind of accepted that, I feel like. And yet the girls I went to school with, you know, as we've grown up and become women, have started to notice in the workplace the things that it's like, oh, okay, no, in the workplace and in the community, okay, there are still some inequalities here and some disadvantages. Only noticed them when they started happening to us or our friends. And I feel like the blokes that I grew up with, it's only now that they're even getting that message, like, oh, but I thought things were cool. Like, I don't understand why everyone's freaking out now, because they haven't seen it until now.
Yeah. And I think sometimes when you're benefiting from the privilege, it's difficult, even more difficult to see it, because you're not necessarily a bad person.
Oh, no.
You just can't see it from the perspective of that. Yeah.
Well, the fish doesn't know because it doesn't, right? It just doesn't.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And I think also that good girl thing, for me, there was obviously there are patriarchal histories within any Christian church. And even though there was a female figurehead, like, I obviously went to the church where my mother was preaching most of my life, so most of the time I've seen a woman up the front. But then there's that whole thing about a woman in leadership has to be, like, extra perfect, because they're going to be more criticized than a man anyway. You know, we saw that with Julia Gillard. Like, there was just, it's great that there's a woman in leadership, but they're under so many more pressures to kind of be the good girl once they're there, that I feel like I got that double whammy as well of, and I don't want to speak for my mother, because I don't necessarily know what it was like for her, but certainly growing up, I felt like I had to maintain her image. You know, she's the figurehead here. She's the, and we were in a fairly small town, so everybody knew her and everybody knew that I was the minister's kid, you know, my sister and I. And I was the oldest child as well, which obviously there's all sorts of keeping up appearances and high achieving things there.
Yeah, we're all fucked up.
Yeah. Well, but really it was like I felt like I had to maintain this image of good little Christian girl for the sake of my mother. I didn't want to embarrass her. I didn't want, and then there's that stereotype of ministers' kids are either like sluts and rebels or these kind of prissy, perfect little good girls. And it was like, I really just went with the good girl role.
Do you think you were the good girl, or was there a little rebel slut hiding inside you?
I would say it's only been in the last probably 5 years that I feel like my rebel has come out And I'm married now, so this is, so I don't know, I'm not going to comment on this.
Slight days are over.
There never were any. Whether I would have liked there to be any, I mean, I just don't think it even entered my head because yeah. I had to be the good girl, you know what I mean? But certainly that I feel like it's only been in the last couple of years that I've been like rebelling in inverted commas. Because I'm an adult now and I don't live in the town where I grew up, where people, you know, even after my mum moved away and became the moderator of the Uniting Church in Queensland and stuff, I was still in that region for a while. And I felt like this is my role. This is who I have to be. And it wasn't until I moved away that I felt like, oh, nobody knows me here. I can do whatever I want.
So what does a good girl do?
Yeah. Well, I was really high achieving, you know, classic goody two shoes at school, teacher's pet. Like I was in the band, so I was a total band geek. I went to band camp, but it wasn't that kind of band camp. And I was very studious. I did lots of extracurricular activities that also were high achieving. Like I didn't just play piano. I played piano and got honours on my piano exams, you know. So there was a lot of music involved. There was a lot of, like, even my friendship groups were, like, good girl friendship groups. And I didn't really go to parties and I certainly wasn't participating in any kind of underage drinking or anything. I was a good girl. Read a lot of books. Pretty quiet life, really.
So pretty much did, the opposite to me.
Probably. And really, I guess there were probably some times where I felt like I wanted to break out, but I didn't because it wasn't my role, you know. But also I'm an extremely cautious person. I was also really scared. Like certainly in my university days, I can think of some times where I was like, oh, I'd love to, you know, let loose and like go partying or be a slut or whatever. But it was like, oh, but the consequences, no, I wouldn't, you know, like I was just too fucking responsible for a 17-year-old. Like I went to Italy as an exchange student after I'd finished school, and I was only 17, but I did turn 18 while I was there. But of course in Italy, drinking at the age of 16, you're having a glass of wine with the family around the dinner table is not unusual. That like all the, you know, when I went out to dinner with the friends I made at my Italian school, everyone would order a glass of wine. Like that was normal, except me, because even though it was totally allowed over there, I knew it was not allowed in Australia and I was only 17 and I didn't drink the whole time I was in Italy. Like that's insane when I look back on it, but I was just really responsible. And then I even followed that up with like with my career choice, because I decided to go and become a high school teacher, where it was really then the same thing. Like I go around and I follow rules and then I enforce rules on these other kids that now I'm in charge of. It was just like a perpetuating cycle, I think. It's interesting too, because yeah. I didn't really want to be a teacher, but I didn't know what else to do. So that was like the good girl career choice, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I did the same thing. I didn't know what I wanted to do, and so I did teaching.
Yeah.
But I only lasted 1 year, because then I was like, what am I doing? I hate kids. So this ain't going to be fun.
We see, I think it was really-
and then I did arts because I still didn't know what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
When you don't know, you do teaching or you do arts.
Exactly. Well, and I did, like, I really wanted to be a Japanese translator when I was at high school. I knew that I wanted to learn other languages, which is part of the reason I went to Italy on my exchange. And then I came back and I enrolled in a Japanese teacher program. I really enrolled in it for the Japanese, not for the teaching. But then once I got onto pracs and into the classroom, I actually really loved it. So that's why I stayed. Like I sort of signed up to the teaching degree, not thinking that's what I wanted to do. But then once I had a go at it, I was like, actually, I'm really good at this and I really like it. I like kids, so that helps. I did choose high school though, because I'm not great with bodily functions and I know that little children have a lot of those. So I was quite happy with the high school kids. Teenagers don't scare me. So But then at uni, it's interesting in hindsight that I didn't really want to be a teacher. And then at uni, I ended up with a lot of health problems. And for a while there, we thought I might not even finish my degree, let alone be physically well enough to teach. And in hindsight, I really wonder if that was also, that was partly my high achiever kind of Protestant work ethic, you know, if you're resting, then you must be doing the devil's work sort of thing. Not that that was really a message that I got a lot in my household, but somewhere along the lines of hanging out in churches, I picked it up. And I really worked myself into the ground when I was at uni, ended up with chronic fatigue syndrome, which in hindsight quite possibly was adrenal fatigue. I had glandular fever, as most people do at university, just never got better.
I did
for
too.
3 years. It was a pretty, it was probably that first year that I was really unwell, and I had a boyfriend who we just were not meant to be. He wasn't particularly nice. That particular year was probably the darkest year of my life. And I mean, I was still living at home, so I was very well looked after. But I think in hindsight, that was probably my body and my subconscious mind or whatever trying to throw up some red flags to say, maybe this is not the career that you need to be pursuing. And maybe this is not the lifestyle, you know, that kind of hustle, hustle, hustle lifestyle. I know that burnout's been a bit of a theme on your podcast recently. It's interesting to me that a lot of people, sort of a lot of women that I talk to now, seem to go through that experience of working themselves into the ground in their kind of late 20s, early 30s. And it really happened to me at the age of 19, like when I was 19 and 20.
Same with me. I was exactly the same. I had taken on, I was doing uni, I had 3 jobs, I was living in a fairly abusive relationship, and I ended up with glandular fever. That was really my burnout. It stopped me from actually finishing uni. So I did four years and was only a few, maybe 2 or 3 units shy of graduating.
Yeah.
But I was just so sick and tired. I couldn't go back, and then I just realized I don't really need this degree anyway to do what I want to do. And I went into sales. So, and then I just became a very lazy salesman who just, you know, would stay at home until 11 o'clock watching a country practice before hitting the road. So I kind of inadvertently learned how to protect my energy, but felt huge amount of guilt about that too. So I think that early burnout really helped me become lazy.
Yeah. Well, it didn't help me become lazy. It took me, like, I didn't learn my lesson. I'd already been obviously hustling too hard and burning the candle at both ends, not from partying, more from, I did stay up late a lot and, you know, go out to the pub, but I was usually designated driver because even once I was legally able to drink, it was still, that's not what good girls do, in somewhere in the back catalogue of my mind. And then so I got glandular fever, and the doctor said, well, you know, you're going to have to slow down. But I got a second job, a second part-time job teaching piano after school. And then I was still doing uni, and then I started a local fundraising quest. So I didn't learn my lesson. So it's really no wonder, because it was my body saying, slow the fuck down. And my ego thought that if I slowed down, if I wasn't doing something, then, you know, I wasn't enough. It's that whole not good enough story. And so really it was probably 2.5 years later, when I was diagnosed with thyroid cancer, that I finally went, oh fuck, maybe I need to listen here. Maybe this hustle isn't getting me anywhere, and I need to, you know, stop. And the word cancer stops most people in their tracks, I think.
Yeah. And how old were you when you got the diagnosis?
I was 22.
Unusual?
Thyroid cancer in and of itself is not, it's not super common, but it's certainly one that can affect young people. It's also, and I do not want to speak lightly of it, but I had a pretty easy time of cancer, in the sense that I had a couple of surgeries, and losing a thyroid is not a small thing. Like, that's going to affect me for the rest of my life. But I didn't have to have chemo or even radioactive iodine therapy, which is the standard treatment for thyroid cancer because mine hadn't spread, it was very, it was encapsulated. So I was really, really lucky in that sense. And then
I had a fair amount of... How did you discover you had it? Like what happened there?
I had lumps in my throat, you know, like, so the thyroid is a gland at the front of the throat, just above the collarbone. And, I mean, I'd had glandular fever and then like chronic tonsillitis. So my glands were always up. I always felt like I had a lumpy fat throat. And then it was just one day I actually read a magazine article, the April 2010 issue of Notebook magazine, where they had an article about a woman with thyroid cancer who had a lump, you know, in the front of her throat. And I was like, oh, I've got a lump in the front of my throat. Oh, well, next time I go to the doctor, I'll ask the doctor. And it was just so happened that I couldn't get into my normal doctor, who I think thought I was a malingerer, you know, because of the chronic fatigue, which is like an invisible mystery illness, and
doesn't really exist.
No, exactly. It's all in your head, exactly. But also, in hindsight, I should have seen a different doctor, and I couldn't get into that doctor, so I went to somebody else, and she really followed it up, and yeah, there were biopsies and things, and it turned out that I had that lump in my throat wasn't actually the cancer. I had like four or five different lumps in my thyroid. But one of the other ones was cancer. So it was a really big wake up call. And I was right at the end of my university degree. My now husband and I had been together for about 3 weeks. So I was like, well, he's out of here. Like shit just got heavy real fast. But he didn't run away. Turns out it wasn't like the rest of them. And I for the first time had 3 full months off everything. I think that was the first time I'd probably in my whole life allowed myself to actually just not do anything but heal. And even then, I mean, I had to probably go back to work in inverted commas, which was back to uni, probably sooner than I would have liked, just so I could finish my degree, because it was really close to the end. And then I started teaching the beginning of the next year, about 6 months later. And first year teaching is is not gentle on the body or the mind. So then there was a whole nother layer of learning to look after myself and learning to find some kind of balance, which I sort of don't think exists, like proper balance, but at least I had finally had a real wake-up call to go, yeah, you know, like life is not – nothing in this life is guaranteed. None of us get out of this alive. So I might as well start really thinking about my choices in life. And I think it was the best thing that could have ever happened to me, actually, as a young person. I know that's a bit of a twisted thing to say, and I do not want to glorify cancer at all. But it was really fucking scary. So in hindsight, a lot of the other – decisions that I've had to make along the way in my 20s, you know, as you do, as you grow up, have been and letting go of that good girl thing. I can always kind of think back on that and think, yeah, but if they told me tomorrow I was only going to have 3 months to live, I actually have a really good sense of what a diagnosis like that feels like. Not that that was my diagnosis, but still the word cancer makes your brain go there, even when the doctors are saying, oh, don't worry, you'll survive. Your brain's still going, oh, my God, I'm going to die. It really puts a lot of things in perspective. And I think that that was a really good lesson to learn at the age of – I just turned 23.
Wow, that's insane. Yeah. So how does your life change from that point, from that diagnosis? It sounds like this is probably like not making light of it, but it sounds like cancer might have killed the good girl.
I think so. Actually, that's a good way to put it. But it probably took a little while to sink in. I still had
a number of,
yeah, exactly. And there's always like layers, layers of the onion. And there's still more layers of the onion. and I hope that I have a really long life full of a lot more layers. I think really,
totally.
Because I then went into high school teaching, and I still had the probably the teacher's pet side of the good girl. I probably had less of the good girl in the sense of maybe outside of work. But I essentially hadn't left school yet. Like I went from my own schooling years to university back to school.
Like deeply institutionalized.
Oh, so institutionalized, so worried about things like what color fucking socks people are wearing. Like, and I totally understand why, like, I am very pro uniforms in general, but like, when I think about the amount of headspace that had taken up for me in my life, it's not that important, you know? But, and I love teaching. Like, I really did enjoy it, especially the first year was really rough, and I was at two different schools, the first of which was a really big city school that, like, I had a death threat from a student in my first 3 months of teaching, and it was not a, it was not an idle death threat, let's put it that way. He was a very dangerous student. So, I mean, it's not an easy career at the best of times, but I think on, off the back of, like, 6 months, yeah, 6 months after I'd been diagnosed and then treated for cancer, I began my career, and it was, it's hard work. First-year teaching is fucking hard work. And I had a lot of job insecurity, as a lot of first-year teachers do, because you're on contracts and, you know, you're moving around and stuff. But I really enjoyed the classroom with the kids. I didn't enjoy the paperwork. And I really struggled that good girl thing of, like, I've got to complete all the paperwork properly on time. Like, and some, obviously there are some deadlines with teaching that you can't shift. Some are very, very high stakes, like especially when we're talking about grade 12 final exams and things, but a lot of it is actually not that high stakes, and the deadlines are a little bit more flexible than you think, than you realize in your first year when your boss is telling you you have to have X paperwork done by Y date. So there was a whole probably another layer of good girl stuff, of being the good girl at school, and these are the rules, and you follow, like, very Hermione Granger. You know, very Hermione Granger in the sense of, like, oh, well, this is what the teacher said I have to do, and now I'm the teacher. So if I've said it to the kids, then I've got to walk this talk perfectly as well. That really strong role model thing, which I think also was what I was feeling as a child with my mother, feeling like I've got to protect her reputation. My behavior, my conduct reflects on her. Well, now I'm the teacher, so I've got to, you know, if I'm telling the kids they've got to be wearing the right color socks, well, I better make sure that my dress code is perfect. And if I tell them they have to get their assignments in on time, well, I better get my stuff in on time. So just that same kind of self-talk that was very, very perfectionist in nature, but less perfectionist in the sense that if I don't do it, I'm, you know, if I don't reach some standard, I'm a failure. More like, oh, I'll get in trouble. I was really worried about getting in trouble. That's been a big theme in my life as the good girl, because that was like the worst thing that could possibly happen to me, getting in trouble. And I said, I was still thinking that after I'd had cancer. I don't want to get in trouble. Like, it's nuts when I look back on it. But that was a whole theme for me. And it took me quite a long time, like probably until my last year of teaching, to really feel like I'd let go of that, and that I could just do my job and do a bloody good job, and that if I didn't do it perfectly, nobody was going to sack me.
Yes, so true.
And the kids weren't going to die. So, you know, like, as long as everybody is safe and alive, I'm good.
So you, how long did you teach for? About 6 years?
Yeah, six and a half, I think. Six plus, yeah, basically. But even deciding to leave teaching was probably what really killed the good girl, because I have a very strong sense, you know, that I am my word, and I felt like I'd given my word to this career. I've said I'm going to do this. Well, now I've got to do it forever, even if it kills me. Realizing that I was allowed to say, yeah, this isn't working for me. And I tried a lot of things. You know, I was really lucky. I had a school that supported me when my health, had a number of other health things, ups and downs throughout the years, some of which are just a result of not having a thyroid. Well, you know, like, you need thyroids to live, so I'm on medication forever. And when the medication levels are out of whack, that makes me quite unwell. So there's been that. I've also had to have my tonsils out. I've had some surgery for endometriosis. So there's been a few other things that have impacted my health. You know, I had to go part-time teaching, and that's not always available to everybody, but I'm very grateful that it was available to me at the school that I was at. And I sort of did lots of things to kind of try and work around the fact that probably I just teaching wasn't good for me physically. Like even though I was quite good in the classroom and I loved the kids and I really enjoyed that side of it, all the rest of it, it was not for me. And then I tried everything until I got to a point where I was like, yeah, well, I've tried all the possible options, part-time, changing of subjects and all sorts of things that meant that I can no longer avoid facing up to the fact that I probably shouldn't be doing this anymore. It's really bad for my health. But that was, again, allowing myself to say, you know what, you're allowed. You're not going to get in trouble if you change your mind or if you change your career or if you decide to do something else. You're allowed to do that, Ellen, and you should, because that will be better for your health and your happiness and probably that of the people around you as well.
But a big move to leave teaching completely.
Yeah. And I still didn't really leave teaching completely because one of the entrepreneurial, that's a weird word, one of the business activities that I have going on now is supporting teachers with their health and well-being. And so really there's like, I can't shake it completely. But I've really shaken I won't be back in the classroom. I don't think. I never say never, but I've let my registration lapse. So I'm not going to be, I have no plans to be back in the classroom, but I still really care about schools and teachers and education very, very much. I still haven't completely left.
When did the entrepreneurial bug bite?
I don't actually know. I've only really been working for myself, like not teaching, for just over a year now. I've just about always had something on the side since uni when I was, you know, teaching piano to kids after school. Like that was technically self-employment, not that I really knew much about business. But then also when I was really unwell, I mean, I love reading, but I got into podcasts because, and this was like in 2008, 2009, this was the early days of podcasts. I'm a very proud early adopter of podcasts. And a lot of the podcasts that I was finding and, you know, and audiobooks as well were those kind of online business sort of stories of, and just the interesting stories of people who've made career changes and often end up working for themselves. So it's kind of been in the back of my mind for probably 4 or 5 years, maybe. Yeah, I don't remember it in my first year of teaching, but certainly, I mean, I certainly read Rich Dad, Poor Dad when I was at uni. So there's certainly been an awareness of it for a long time, but I never thought of myself as an entrepreneur or as a business person until probably 2 years ago, I think, when I was really like, okay, I can't teach anymore. What am I going to do instead? What appeals to me, I suppose, about working for myself is that I'm able to work with my health instead of against it. You know, I'm not under anybody else's deadlines and things. So it's been the best thing I could have done for myself physically.
And how did it start?
Well, I started by doing a life coaching course like everybody does. it was generic coaching. So I was able to take it in, you know, life coaching or business coaching or relationship coaching, whatever direction. But I went with the, you know, life and well-being because that's obviously, like, I think living a good life is really important to me and feeling well enough to live a good life. And so that's probably where it really started. In my last couple of years of teaching, I was part-time teaching, so I was coaching a little bit on the side, you know, a couple of clients here and there, and blogging. I started a blog in 2014 with, you know, the grand plans of becoming a millionaire blog owner. That blog no longer exists, by the way. So probably that's where it started, 2014 maybe, with the blog and then the coaching. And then the plan was to leave teaching to coach teachers. But that didn't quite go to plan. And I've ended up basically freelancing, I suppose, doing digital content for people, podcasts in particular, thanks to the newfound skills I have in podcasting from this awesome Radcasters course I did. but a whole bunch of other things like, you know, writing blog posts and video editing and just helping business owners, I suppose, get their message out. Because I really am passionate, I suppose, especially about people that have a message that's going to make a difference in some way. That was one of the things that I loved about teaching, was feeling like I was making a difference. So it's probably important to me to still be doing that. And I don't know whether that's a good girl thing or just something that I think is good in the world, but it probably is stemming, now that I think about it, from that kind of good girl attitude of, you've got to care about other people, otherwise what are you doing with your life?
How did you go from from the vision of you being a coach for other teachers to then now having a busy schedule doing digital content creation and management?
It's not a
regular progression.
No, it really it was my health again. My body knows what's best. My body knows what it needs. And if I'm not, you know, if my head isn't listening, my body gets to a point where it says, well, if you're not going to listen, we'll make you listen. So I started out last year really gung-ho, 100% focused on self-care for teachers, coaching, and I started my podcast for that. That's why I joined Radcasters. And I actually really, because I was focusing on teacher burnout, I was doing a lot of research on that, I kind of burnt myself out, but not in the traditional physically exhausted way, more the mental burnout way of like just completely cynical about that whole subject. And I was probably still a bit too close to my teaching career. I hadn't actually decided to leave yet. I was still employed by Education Queensland. I was just on leave without pay. So I was too close to it all, and I hadn't quite yet cut those ties and given myself, you know, the chance to grieve the career that I had thought I was going to have, because I did need to do that. So the second half, well, probably started in May last year, where that business was not covering its costs. Even though I was really passionate about the subject, I was feeling pretty resentful of the fact that I wasn't making enough money to cover some of my costs. So I just started, and I had all these skills, so I just started helping people online with them. Started on Fiverr, not on Fiverr anymore, but it was a great place to start. And then I actually enjoyed it so much, and especially the introvert in me that was like, I don't have to, you know, I talk to somebody about what they want me to create, but then I just get to go and do the creation, and I don't have to talk to people. It doesn't matter what I look like. I don't have to be feeling particularly well. I could do it on the really first day of my period when I feel like crap, and I could work it into my life in a way that I never felt I could with coaching. And then because it started to pick up, and the second half of the year was extremely busy, I actually let the coaching go, and I thought I was leaving self-care for teachers completely. But now I feel like I've found a bit of a happy medium where I still connect with that content, but I'm not actually working with people one-on-one, because it was sort of wearing me out. And also, it's not really what I want to do. Like, I'm not really a coach, I don't think. I think I'm a teacher more than a coach, if that makes sense.
It does make sense.
And again, it was about allowing myself to pivot, allowing myself to go, oh, yeah, well, I mean, this is what I thought I was going to do, but it's not working for me, so I'm going to change it. I don't have to stick with something just because I said I was going to do it that way or because that's what people expect. Like, there's been a lot of conversations in the last 6 months especially where I'm like having to explain to people, oh, no, this is what I'm doing now. I know it's not what I said I was going to do at the beginning of last year, but deal with it. Like, I don't actually have to answer to those people anyway, so it doesn't matter. You know, I'm in charge of my own life. Light bulb moment. And I'm loving it. You know, I'm really enjoying being able to invest. I've learned some lessons as well, being, you know, first-time freelancer. Learned a lot of lessons about the kind of clients I will work with and the kind that I won't, but also the kind of businesses that I want to work with and the more long-term relationships I'd rather have. I don't, you know, necessarily want to do the one-off stuff, which was what was going on with Fiverr, which is why I left it behind. But I've been able to see inside a lot of other people's businesses as well, which has been really interesting. And also, like, I love learning. I love podcasts and I love being able to learn new things. You know, like, I've been paid to listen to people's podcasts, which is for about 6 months now, which is awesome, But also some of the podcasts are on things that I don't know anything about, like Amazon dropshipping. Like, but I don't have to know. I don't have to be the one in charge. You know, I don't have to, like, as a teacher, I think, and as a, you know, very highly super responsible teenager who was the sober one at the party, making sure people got home okay. Like, I have really had the good girl kind of I'm responsible for other people thing very strongly in my life, and realizing I don't have to be in charge of this. I just get to do this thing. I don't have to know everything about the content because they know the content. It's their business. But I know how to put the content together or how to do this with the podcast or whatever. And that's been really freeing to allow myself to just do it because I like it. And I'm only going to keep doing it until I stop enjoying it, because I don't want to end up again stuck, feeling stuck and feeling like I have to do it because this is what I said I was doing and I have to stick to my word forever.
Yeah, that's such a big thing, right? Like, that was something that I've worked a lot on, like that disappointing people.
Yeah.
And have made big decisions, like when I had to close the membership and eventually close Radcasters.
Yeah.
But for me, when you're making those kind of big decisions, it's like you are thinking, well, it's impacting other people.
Mm.
And, you know, some people are going to be disappointed and some people are going to think you're a flake and whatever, but at the end of the day, they're not living your life. So unless, and until they are, I think then, but also it just is a reflection of their deep sense of responsibility too, you know? So, those decisions are really hard to make. And once you've made them a few times, I feel like they become a little easier. It becomes easier to honor yourself in the process.
Yeah.
But absolutely. Yeah.
And I feel like
the first ones are hard.
Exactly. And I feel like the way my body kind of pulls me up when I'm not listening to whatever direction I'm being called to go in, I feel like that those lessons are getting, because I'm listening sooner probably, I'm no longer getting fucking cancer diagnoses or chronic disease. It's more like, okay, I've got a migraine and I don't really get migraines anymore. So I better listen. What does this mean? Like, and yes, it sometimes means I ate gluten and I shouldn't have. But, you know, usually the reason I ate the gluten is because I was feeling stressed about something that I, you know, obligated to do something that I didn't want to do, and then I was comfort eating or whatever. So it's like I feel like the lessons are, you know, the way my body is communicating, you know, over the last decade, I guess I've been learning that language so that now I can be like, okay, no, I know what I want to do, which is probably what I need to do. And the only barrier here is like the fear of disappointing someone or the fear of getting in trouble or the fear of changing my mind, like of announcing that I've changed my mind. I said I was going to do this, but now I'm doing something else, and what people are going to think. But the more I honor myself, as you say, the more physically well I am. So that's a really good barometer, in my opinion. I mean, I'm getting better at taking care of myself. There's been a lot of lessons, like running a human body is hard work. I think mine is particularly higher maintenance than some, but I'm also getting a lot better at listening when there's a warning signal to turn around and, you know, course correct.
What's next?
I don't know.
Awesome.
I'm really, it's awkward when people are like, what do you do? I'm like, yeah, I don't know how to answer that question. It was so easy when I was a high school teacher because everybody knows what that is.
A neat box.
And it was really easy when I left teaching to then go and help teachers, and that was the only thing I was doing because that was also a neat box. What's next? I'm working with my husband on his business. He's an exercise physiologist, so just getting him online because he's not been online. He's mostly been working for himself in a small town and, well, reasonable sized town here in Toowoomba, and he didn't have a website or anything. So getting all those things set up for him, and I'm really enjoying that because, again, I feel like he's making a difference in the world, in our pocket of the world, and I'm really enjoying working on that. And am writing a book about teacher wellbeing because that subject does not leave me alone. I can't do it full time. Like I I need to have something else outside of school, outside of the education system going on. Otherwise, I think I'll go a bit batty, but I am going to have that book done by the end of the year and, you know, in the next season of my podcast there as well. But I think really what's next is it's probably the most open book I've ever been. I don't have a plan other than to kind of keep doing what I'm doing until it stops working, figure it out. And I'm okay with that. I'm really okay with that. Like, I don't have to have the next 10 years of my life planned out. You know, we hope to have a family, but when, how many, I don't know. I don't have to know. Like, there's a lot of uncertainties, and that used to really scare me. But at the moment, I'm really enjoying the freedom of it. It's hard to explain when people are like, what are you doing with your life? I don't know, but I'm enjoying it. Like, I'm probably happier than I've ever been, and I'm healthier than I've been since I was about 16 years old. So it's working.
So awesome. Then you just got to keep doing it, right? Like, yeah. I feel like most of us are so attached to where we're going. And it is so freeing to just be open.
Yeah.
To figuring it out as you go.
Yeah. And I really feel very strongly that we internally, each of us, like, it's that honoring yourself thing. We sometimes need to go on kind of twisting, turning detours before we figure out which path is the right one. And then even the way, you know, each of us walk our own life path, it's not, you can't plan it. Probably the most influential things and the most life-changing things that have happened to me in my life were never things that I planned.
Or that you would have chosen.
No, exactly. And some of the things that were the best things for me in hindsight were not things that I would have chosen and not necessarily things that I wish on anybody else or want to go through again. So, yeah, I don't know. I just find it really difficult to project. And I think especially being at the stage where it's like, okay, well, I know that probably even in 3 years' time, my life will look completely different. You know, I hope there'll be babies, and I hope that, and I know from watching my friends go through that process that that's going to change everything. So I'm kind of at the point of going, well, I know things are going to change. It doesn't matter how much I worry about that or try and plan for that or organize that. It's not going to actually change how things change. So I'll just enjoy where I am and just keep doing what's working while it works. And it's like, I loved your episode on keeping good company with Nikki Smith about the mini experiments, because I feel like that's exactly what I've been doing with my life all along, but especially in the last 12 months of like, oh, I'm going to try this. Like, oh, I'm going to try seeing if people need some help with their podcast. Oh, a few people do. Oh, okay, cool. And like, this is working and I'm loving it, so I'm going to go with it. That was not in the plan.
Yeah, without pressure and expectation and planning. Yeah. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Time to kick up your feet and relax. It's On the Couch.
Biggest fear.
In the physical realm, I'm not a fan of leeches or spiders. I'm actually a very, like, seriously, when I knew you were going to ask me this question, and I was like, what is my biggest fear? Oh, leeches. But, like, really, on a grander scale, probably ending up crook and stuck again, like, especially the way I was. In some ways, the cancer diagnosis was really freeing for me. And especially because I had sort of 3 years of mystery illness. So then I was kind of able to be like, see, I told you I was sick. But those 3 years of in between where it was like, I'm not well, but I don't know what's wrong with me. And the doctors seem to think I'm making this up, but I'm not okay. That was an awful feeling. And so that's probably being back there in that chronically fatigued, really depressed state is probably what I've been striving to avoid the last 10 years, like with all my work changes and then career changes. And then like, it's all been about creating a life that allows me to look after myself in a way that avoids getting back there. So that, I mean, that's really probably being really unwell like that with seemingly no control over it is probably really my biggest fear.
And what is your biggest struggle at the moment?
Well, other than explaining what the heck it is I'm doing with my life, I'm actually really struggling with the online world. I'm making some big changes in the way I turn up on social media, and not even turn up that other people can see, but, you know, pulling out of Facebook groups and things. And I'm not really enjoying being online. Not that it ever should have been a hobby, you know what I mean? Like, but it does take up, it just kind of creeps into life. So I'm probably really struggling with that at the moment, and I'm setting some big boundaries with myself around social media and around screen time in general, and just like going outside instead and like talking to my husband face to face, reading an actual book. I mean, I still listen to a lot of podcasts and audiobooks and things, but probably I feel like my biggest struggle, other than just the daily, it's not a struggle, but the daily effort that is keeping myself well, because yeah, my body is high maintenance just to be 80% of the battery that other people have. It's probably the online world, and especially because there's a lot of things to care about, like the mental load, I feel like, of the Harvey Weinstein stuff and refugees, and like there's so many things in the world that I care about, you know. But at the same time, I know logically that it's the best time in human history to be living on this planet, even amidst all those shit things that are going on. So I feel like keeping that in focus and reminding myself that right here, right now, I'm okay, I'm safe, and I can do what I can do in my circle of influence, and then I don't have to stay plugged into that other stuff all the time. That's a bit of a struggle, and sticking to my boundaries with that.
Yeah, I totally feel you. Not great at sticking to boundaries around that. So,
not the self-imposed ones anyway.
yeah, exactly. Failure, what does failure mean to you?
It's an interesting question, because I don't feel like I've had any massive failures in my life. You know, I was a high achiever. I pretty much always did really well. You know, the one time I cheated on something growing up was a piano practice competition, and I ended up winning the competition, which I knew I didn't deserve, and I never cheated again, you know, so it was like a good lesson. I think for me, probably failure is the teacher hat, the Hermione Granger good girl, teacher's pet, and then running the classroom teacher hat. There's kind of a meaning of failure for that that's obviously not good enough. But I don't really identify with that anymore. And I probably feel more like failure is, and that it's a coaching thing of like failure is feedback. But even from the musician in me knows that like there's absolutely no way to get better at a musical instrument without making 1,000 mistakes. That's how you learn. Like, you obviously want to be trying not to make too many mistakes and practicing the mistakes, but failure is how you learn. Yeah. But having said that, I don't feel like I've had a massive life failure like your office collective or something. I haven't had something like that happen to me. So who am I to say?
Yeah. What can I say about that one? But again, like, biggest lesson ever. And I learned a few more after that.
Yeah.
From the same place. And, you know, just more layers of the onion.
Exactly.
Mine was I think there's so many different ways we can fail, in terms of, you know, we can fail ourselves and we can fail to listen to the voice within us. And
absolutely,
mine was just a big public failure, but there's been so many fails on a daily basis. Yeah. And for me, it's just that it's not a negative or a positive thing anymore. It's just, part of the learning process and part of the creative process.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes things fall apart before they come back together, you know, at the retreat we did the basket making. The basket sometimes has to come apart before it can come back together.
Exactly.
And our attachment is in not letting it fall apart. which is problematic because it needs to happen.
Exactly.
And yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And that's the whole thing, right? Like so many people are trying to avoid the failure, and the failure is often the thing that brings you back together. It's like the cancer diagnosis for you. It's
it was the wake up call that I needed. Yeah.
Yeah, the death of a certain part of us that wasn't perhaps serving us,
yeah,
or our highest good. So,
yeah.
And well, that process is often painful but also hugely rewarding.
Exactly. And probably the one big thing that I have failed in my life was my Japanese proficiency test. It's a long story, but I did a Japanese teaching degree and then I ended up teaching mostly music because to teach in Education Queensland, you need to do this proficiency test. And it's huge, like higher than university level stuff. And anyway, I failed the reading section of it because Japanese characters there's a lot of characters. That meant that I actually had a Japanese teacher scholarship with Ed Queensland when I was finishing uni. And I lost that scholarship, which then meant that I didn't end up with a permanent teaching job straight out of uni like I thought I was going to have. And I wasn't teaching Japanese, I was teaching music instead. And so that was devastating at the time because that was a big loss of like, oh, where I thought I was going. But again, that was not a bad thing in hindsight because, you know, I might not have ended up marrying the man I married because I would have been stuck in a particular place with a permanent job where I couldn't move around, whereas I was free to follow him when he got a job here. And yeah, so failure, I don't know, failure always, I think, leads to something good afterwards.
Yeah. Absolutely. Success. What does success mean to you?
Well, I mean, it's an equally nebulous thing, I feel like, because in a lot of ways, I wouldn't say that I have the tick boxes to be able to say I'm successful. Like I don't have a hugely successful business and I don't have like X amount of bazillion Instagram followers. But at the same time, I've kind of created the life that I wanted for myself, and I can't think of any better definition of success. Like really, there's not a lot that I would add to my life or take away from my life to create my ideal weeks at the moment. And that's amazing. And, you know, 4 years ago when I was feeling resentful on my 1 hour commute to work and like listening to podcasts of people doing what they want with their life, thinking, oh, I can never do that. Like I've got to do my bloody report cards and feeling frustrated about that kid in the grade 9 class who's being a, you know, rat bag. This is what I wanted. And actually, oh my God, I did it.
But you could never have imagined that this was what you wanted.
Yeah, well, exactly. Because it, you know what I mean? Mundane. Like, you could
never have imagined that you'd be doing the things that you're doing now.
Yes. Even this time last year, I did not expect to be where I am now. Certainly in terms of what I'm doing mostly day to day for work. And like, really, it's so not Instagram worthy. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like I've made it, but it's such a mundane life, but that's so precious to me. So I don't know. I don't know if that's, success. There's these two definitions of like, well, one, it's got to be Instagram worthy. You've got to be doing all these amazing things that you can shout from the rooftops. But at the same time, I'm like, yeah, but I get to do what I want with my life and I get paid to listen to podcasts. So like that is success. And I'm well, you know,
totally. And well. Freedom. What is freedom?
Oh, well, freedom is being able to do exactly what I've done. Like, especially from the perspective of, it doesn't happen overnight, but like you can create the life that you want, especially if you live in Australia. Like, yes, there are going to be restrictions, financial pressures, family obligations, you know, yes, all of that exists, but like you can change your life if you want to, especially in the Western world, even if you're poor, you know, even if you've had disadvantaged background, like we still have so much control and agency over our own lives, and the internet only makes that even more so. So I think freedom is just the ability to choose what happens to my life and my body and my life and my body, basically.
And I just want to point out too that you've really backed yourself, you've really taken chances and taken risks that, you know, most people will uphold the status quo and and live a life that feels like it wasn't made for them because they feel like they should, because they have to be the good girl, or because they don't think there's any alternative for them. And so, and you haven't, you know, you've honored yourself, you've honored your body, and you have, you've taken chances. And some of them haven't worked, and some of them have worked amazingly.
Yeah. So, some of them worked ways I didn't expect.
That's bold and big.
Well, thank you. And I, like, cause I'm not, like, I'm not a physical risk taker, you know, like, I'm not going for a walk in the rainforest. There are leeches there. But you're right. Like, I really, I listen when my body, sometimes it has to scream, but I listen. And I'm not the only one that's backed me. Like, my husband has backed me as well, and I've had a lot of support. So it's not like I've done this all on my own. But yeah, it has been a really big journey of shaking off that good girl and realizing that I'm allowed to choose what I do and how I do it and who I do it with. And it doesn't matter what other people think about that, as long as I'm making the choice I want to make.
The plug. Instead of filling the podcast with self-promotion, we're being totally transparent. Here's the plug.
I don't know. I don't know what to plug. I don't know what I'm doing. So probably, I mean, self-care for teachers is like my main pluggable thing, which, you know, you can find it. selfcareforteachers.com.au or just at selfcareforteachers on Facebook and Instagram. That's obviously if you're a teacher or for teachers that you know. And I have a teacher wellbeing podcast, which is on iTunes. But if you want to just follow the rest of my journey, I also have just set up an Ellen Ronalds Keen Facebook page and an Instagram, which is Ellen_Ronalds Keen. I'll send you the links, Carly.
I'll put links in the show.
Yeah. And yes, because most of the work that I've done, you know, I don't have a website for my other stuff. It's been mostly either on, you know, there was a bit of Fiverr stuff, or it's just been like word of mouth stuff. So yeah, hit me up, and I plan to be doing a lot more, like when I eventually have a website for that, like blogging and stuff, just about the decisions I'm making with my life and how I'm shedding more of that good girl and doing more of the honoring myself thing, which is hopefully helpful to people. And if not, that's cool too.
Yeah. Well, I think it is, because it's pretty much what I've been doing. And it works. It does work. It sometimes doesn't make any sense, but it works.
Well, I find it really interesting to even to just watch people that are maybe making choices that I would never, ever, ever, like, I'm like, oh, I don't want to be Bear Grylls. I'm afraid of nature. But you can still learn from the way other people approach their life too and decisions they make. And yeah, I just find that interesting.
The takeaway: exercises or tips for positive change sprinkled with salt and vinegar, wrapped in newspaper and handed over the counter from our special guest to you.
I think listen to your body, but also listen to your resentment. Because I really think that resentment, and like if you want a book recommendation, especially if you're a woman, highly recommend The Dance of Anger by Harriet Lerner, L-E-R-N-E-R. Absolutely excellent book about female anger and how we are taught to be either the good girl who doesn't speak up for ourselves or the bitch, and it's like they're the only two options. But listen to your anger and make friends with your guilt, because I feel like resentment and guilt are two sides of the same coin. And usually if you feel resentful about something, it's because, you know, you've said yes to something you didn't want to do. But if you'd said no, you would feel guilty. Or if you do something for yourself, you would feel guilty.
Yes.
And like so many of us, I think, are so afraid of our guilt that we choose resentment. We're really comfortable with resentment. It's speaking to us and it's pretty toxic. Like sitting in resentment is not a good place. It's not a good thing for a relationship. It's not a good thing for a, you know, a life situation. So I think listen to your resentment and make friends with your guilt, because you can make friends with guilt. Resentment is not a friend. So listen to it and then choose your own agenda, really, for your life, because you're allowed to.
I think that was the best takeaway I've ever had.
Oh, wow.
That was amazing.
That's very
I nice. Love that. I love the idea of resentment being on the same side, like, you know, on the same side of the coin or on the flip side of the coin to guilt, because it's so true. We can choose to stay in the resentment and be powerless, the victim to whatever is going on, or we can flip that coin and accept the guilt.
Yeah.
And guilt goes away. That may initially come with it, but guilt fades. Yeah. Resentment doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. Resentment can kill you.
Yes. Yeah, because it eats away inside you, and it eats away at your relationships, and it eats away at the joy in life. Whereas guilt, like most of the time I've, you know, especially with a business name with self-care in the business name, like self-care has been a huge journey for me. But like guilt, most of the time when we feel guilty for doing things that are like, oh my God, I took an afternoon off and did something for me, and we feel guilty about that. It's mostly false guilt. Like we haven't actually done anything wrong. You know, nobody was hurt. Even if they were inconvenienced, that's not our problem. Like if something is inconvenient for somebody else, it's like, that doesn't mean it's wrong. And I think a lot of the time, you know, women have been conditioned to, and we've seen our mothers do it and our grandmothers, et cetera, choose resentment every time, because guilt is too scary. But it's not real guilt, which is why it fades. So make friends with that.
Sweet. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning into Carlosophies. If you really dug this app, I'd love for you to share it with someone who you think might also dig it. Really helps me to spread the word. And if you'd like to get to know me a little better and see some in-between app thoughts and insights and be around some super cool people, join my Facebook tribe, Show Up Speak Up. Search Show Up Speak Up in Facebook or head to carlinimmo.com/tribe. Until next time, be real, be rad. Peace out.